Eden and his mother. He'd prayed about it, looking for strength, for guidance. And yet the vision of Amanda's tiny blue fingernails, the faint wheeze of her breathing, never left him. And the looming stones by the creek on Ocracoke seemed to grow nearer, more solid, day by day. Bobby Higgins was indeed in the graveyard, his horse tethered under the pines. He was sitting by Mulver's grave, head bowed in contemplation, though he looked up at once when Roger and the boys appeared. He looked pale and somber, but scrambled to his feet and shook Roger's hand.
"I'm glad to see you back, Bobby. Here, you lot. Go and play, aye?"
He set Jemmy down, and was pleased to see that after one suspicious glance at Mulver's grave, adorned with a wilted bunch of wildflowers, Jemmy went off quite happily with Aidan to hunt for squirrels and chipmunks in the wood.
I wasn't expecting to see you again, he added, a little awkwardly.
Bobby looked down, slowly dusting pine needles from his breeches.
Well, sir, the fact of the matter is, I've come to stay. If so be as that's agreeable, he added hastily. To stay? But of course it's fine, Roger said, recovering from his surprise. Have you, that is, you've not had a falling out with his lordship, I hope?
Bobby looked astonished at the thought and shook his head decidedly.
Oh, no, sir. His lordship's been proper kind to me ever since he took me on.
He hesitated, biting his lower lip.
It's only... Well, you see, sir, there's a deal of folk what come to stay with his lordship these days. Politicals and army folk.
Despite himself, he touched the brand on his cheek, which had faded now to a pinkish scar, but was still apparent, and always would be. Roger understood.
You weren't comfortable there any longer, I suppose. That's it, sir.
Bobby gave him a grateful look.
Time was, 'twas just his lordship and me and Manicky the cook. Sometimes a guest would come for dinner or to stay a few days, but 'twas all easy and what you might call simple. When I went for to run messages or errands for his lordship, folk would stare, but only for the first time or two. After that, they'd be used to this.
He touched his face again, and it was all right.
But now...
He trailed off unhappily, leaving Roger to imagine the probable response of British Army officers, starched, polished, and either openly disapproving of this blot on the service, or painfully polite.
His lordship saw the difficulty. He's good that way. And he said as though he would miss me. But if I chose to seek my fortune elsewhere, he would give me £10 and his best wishes.
Roger whistled respectfully. £10 was a very respectable sum. Not a fortune, but quite enough to set Bobby on his road.
Very nice, he said. Did he know you meant to come here?
Bobby shook his head.
I wasn't sure myself, he admitted. Once I should...
He cut himself off abruptly, with a glance at Mulver's grave, then turned back to Roger, clearing his throat.
I thought I'd best talk to Mr. Fraser before I was to make up my mind. Could be there's naught for me here any longer, either.
This was phrased as a statement, but the question was clear. Everyone on the ridge knew Bobby and accepted him. That wasn't the difficulty. But with Lizzie married and Mulver gone... Bobby wanted a wife.
"Oh, I think you might find yourself welcome," Roger said, with a thoughtful look at Aidan hanging upside down by his knees from a tree branch, while Jemmy pegged pine cones at him.
A most peculiar feeling went through him, something between gratitude and jealousy. But he pushed the latter feeling firmly down.
"Aidan," he shouted, "Jem, time to go."
And turned casually back to Bobby, saying,
"I think you'll maybe not have met Aidan's mother, Amy McCullum. A young widow, I, with a house and a bit of land. She's come to work at the big house. If you'll come, sit down to supper there." "I've thought of it, now and then," Jamie admitted. "Wondered you can. What if I could? How would it be?"
He glanced at Brianna, smiling, but a little helpless, and shrugged.
"What do you think, lass? What should I do there? How would it be?"
"Well, it..." she began, and stopped, trying to envision him in that world, behind the wheel of a car, going to an office in a three-piece suit. That idea was so ludicrous she laughed. Or sitting in a darkened theatre watching Godzilla films with Jem and Roger.
"What's Jamie spelled backward?" she asked.
"Image, I suppose," he replied, bewildered. "Why?"
"I think you'd do fine," she said, smiling. "Never mind. You'd...
well, I suppose you could publish newspapers. The printing presses are bigger and faster, and it takes a lot more people to gather the news, but otherwise, I don't think it's so different then from what it is now. You know how to do that."
He nodded, a crease of concentration forming between the thick brows that was so like hers.
"I suppose so,"
he said, a little dubiously.
"Could I be a farmer, do you think? Surely folks still eat. Someone must feed them."
"You could."
She looked round, taking fresh note of all the homely details of the place. The chickens scratching peaceably in the dirt, the soft weathered boards of the stable, the thrown-up dirt near the foundation of a house where the white pig had burrowed in.
"There are people, then, who still farm just this way. Small places, way up in the mountains.
It's a hard life." She saw him smile and laughed in return. "All right. It's not any harder than it is now. But it's a lot easier in the cities." She paused, thinking.
"You wouldn't have to fight," she said finally.
He seemed surprised at that. "No. But you did see there are wars."
"There certainly are," she said, needles of ice piercing her belly as the images pierced her mind. "Fields of poppies. Fields of white crosses. A man on fire. A naked child running with burned skin. The contorted face of a man in the instant before the bullet entered his brain. But then it's only the young men who fight. And not all of them. Only some."
"Mm-hmm."
He thought for a bit, his brow furrowed, then looked up, searching her face.
"This world of yours, this America," he said finally, matter-of-factly. "The freedom that you go to. There will be a fearful price to be paid. Will it be worth it, do you think?"
It was her turn, then, to be silent and think. At last she put her hand on his arm, solid, warm, steady as iron.
"Almost nothing would be worth losing you," she whispered. "But maybe that comes close."
As the world turns toward winter and the nights grow long, people begin to wake in the dark. Lying in bed too long cramps the limbs, and dreams dreamt too long turn inward on themselves, grotesque as a mandarin's fingernails. By and large, the human body isn't adapted for more than 7 or 8 hours sleep. But what happens when the nights are longer than that? What happens is the second sleep. You fall asleep from tiredness soon after dark, but then wake again, rising toward the surface of your dreams like a trout coming up to feed. And should your sleeping partner also wake then, and people who have slept together for a good many years know at once when each other wakes, you have a small, private place to share, deep in the night. A place in which to rise, to stretch, to bring a juicy apple back to bed, to share, slice by slice, fingers brushing lips. To have the luxury of conversation uninterrupted by the business of the day. To make love slowly in the light of an autumn moon. And then to lie close and let a lover's dreams caress your skin as you begin to sink once more beneath the waves of consciousness, blissful in the knowledge that dawn is far off. That's second sleep. I came very slowly to the surface of my first sleep to find that the highly erotic dream I'd been having had some basis in reality.
"I'd never thought myself the sort who'd molest a corpse, Sassenach."
Jamie's voice tickled the tender flesh below my ear, murmuring,
but I will say the notion has more appeal than I'd thought.
I wasn't sufficiently coherent as to respond to this, but thrust my hips back toward him in a fashion that he seemed to find as eloquent an invitation as one written in calligraphy on parchment. He took a deep breath, a firm grip on my buttocks, and brought me to an awakening that could be called rude in several senses of the word. I squirmed like a worm impaled on a fishhook, making small urgent noises that he interpreted correctly, rolling me onto my face, and proceeding to leave me in no doubt that I was not merely alive and awake, but functioning. I emerged at length from a nest of flattened pillows, damp, gasping, quivering in every engorged and slippery nerve ending, and thoroughly awake. "What brought that on?" I inquired. He hadn't pulled away. We lay still joined, washed in the light of a big golden half-moon riding low in the sky above the chestnut trees. He made a small sound, partly amusement, partly dismay.
"I canna look at you asleep without wanting to wake you, Sassenach."
His hand cupped my breast, gently now.
"I suppose I find myself lonely without you."
There was an odd note in his voice, and I turned my head toward him, but couldn't see him in the dark behind me. Instead, I put back a hand and touched the leg still wrapped halfway over mine. Even relaxed, it was hard, the long groove of the muscle graceful under my fingers. "I'm here," I said, and his arm tightened suddenly around me. I heard the breath catch in his throat, and my hand tightened on his thigh. "What is it?" I said. He drew breath, but didn't answer at once. I felt him draw back a little and fumble under the pillow. Then his hand came round me again, but this time seeking the hand that lay on his leg. His fingers curled into mine, and I felt a small, hard, roundish object thrust into my hand. I heard him swallow. The stone, whatever it was, seemed slightly warm to the touch. I ran a thumb slowly over it, a raw stone of some kind, but big, the size of one of my finger joints. "Jamie," I said, feeling my throat close.
"I love you," he said,
so softly that I barely heard him, close as we were. I lay still for a moment, feeling the stone grow warmer in the palm of my hand. Surely it was imagination that made it seem to throb in time with my heart. Where on earth had he gotten it? Then I moved, not suddenly, but with deliberation, my body sliding slowly free of his. I rose, feeling light-headed, and crossed the room, pushed open the window to feel the sharp touch of the autumn wind on my naked, bed-warm skin, and, drawing back my arm, hurled the tiny object into the night. Then I came back to bed, saw his hair a dark mass on the pillow, and the shine of his eyes in the moonlight. "I love you," I whispered, and slid under the sheet beside him, putting my arms around him, hugging him close, warmer than the stone, so much warmer, and his heart beat with mine.
"I'm none so brave as I was before, Ken," he said, very softly. "Not brave enough to live without you any more."
"But brave enough to try." I drew his head down to me, stroking the tumble of his hair, coarse and smooth at once, live beneath my fingers.
"Lay your head, man," I said softly. "It's a long time till dawn."
Chapter 120. If only for myself. The sky was a flat leaden colour, threatening rain, and the wind gusted through the palmettos, rattling the leaves like sabres. Down in the depths of the tidal forest, the four stones loomed beside the creek. "I am the wife of the Laird of Balneen," Brianna whispered next to me. "The fairies have stolen me over again." She was white to the lips,
Amanda clutched close to her breast.
We had made our farewells. We had been saying farewell, I thought, since the day I pressed the stethoscope to Mandy's heart.
But Brianna turned and flung herself, baby and all, at Jamie, who pressed her so tight against his heart, I thought one of them must break. Then she was flying at me, a cloud of cloak and loosened hair, and her face was cold against mine, her tears and mine mingling on my skin. "I love you, Mama. I love you," she said, in desperation, then turned and, without looking back, began to walk the pattern Donna had described, quietly chanting under her breath. A circle right, between two stones, a circle left, and back through the centre, and then to the left of the largest stone. I had been expecting it. When she began to walk the pattern, I had run away from the stones, stopping at what I thought a safe distance. It wasn't. The sound of them, a roar this time instead of a shriek, thundered through me, stopping my breath and nearly my heart. Pain froze in a band round my chest, and I dropped to my knees, swaying and helpless. They were gone. I could see Jamie and Roger running to check, terrified of finding bodies, at once desolate and elated to find none. I couldn't see very well. My vision swam, flickering in and out, but didn't need to. I knew they were gone, from the hole in my heart. "Two down," Roger whispered. His voice was no more than a faint rasp, and he cleared his throat hard. "Jeremiah." He looked down at Jem, who blinked and sniffed, and drew himself up tall at the sound of his formal name. "You ken what we're about now, aye?" Jemmy nodded, though he flicked a scared glance toward the towering stone where his mother and his baby sister had just vanished. He swallowed hard and wiped the tears off his cheeks. "Well, then." Roger reached out a hand and rested it gently on Jemmy's head. "Know this, Mumak. I shall love you all my life and never forget you. But this is a terrible thing we're doing, and you need not come with me. You can stay with your granda and Granny Claire. It'll be all right."
Won't I see Mama again?"
Jamie's eyes were huge and he couldn't keep from looking at the stone.
"I don't know," Roger said,
and I could see the tears he was fighting himself and hear them in his thickened voice. He didn't know whether he would ever see Brianna again himself, or baby Mandy.
"Probably. Probably not."
Jamie looked down at Jem, who was clinging to his hand, looking back and forth between father and grandfather, confusion, fright, and longing in his face.
"If one day, Awalach," Jamie said conversationally, "you should meet a very large mouse named Michael, you'll tell him your grandsire sends his regards."
He opened his hand then, letting go, and nodded toward Roger. Jem stood staring for a moment, then dug in his feet and sprinted toward Roger, sand spurting from under his shoes. He leapt into his father's arms, clutching him around the neck, and with a final glance backward, Roger turned and stepped behind the stone, and the inside of my head exploded in fire. Unimaginable time later, I came slowly back, coming down from the clouds in fragments like hailstones, and found myself lying with my head in Jamie's lap, and heard him saying softly to himself or to me,
"For your sake I will continue, though for mine alone I would not."
Chapter 121. Across the Abyss. 3 nights later, I woke from a restless sleep in an inn in Wilmington, my throat parched as the salt bacon I had eaten in the dinner stew. Sitting up to find water, I found that I was alone. The moonlight through the window shone white on the vacant pillow beside me. I found Jamie outside, behind the inn, his nightshirt a pale blotch in the darkness of the inn-yard. He was sitting on the ground with his back against a chopping block, arms wrapped about his knees. He didn't speak as I came toward him, but turned his head, body shifting in a silent welcome. I sat down on the chopping block behind him, and he leaned his head back against my thigh with a long, deep sigh. "Couldn't sleep." I touched him gently, smoothing back the hair from his face. He slept with it unbound, and it fell thick and wild about his shoulders, tangled from bed.
"Nay, I slept," he said quietly.
His eyes were open, looking up at the great gold moon three-quarters full over the aspens near the inn.
"I had a dream."
"A nightmare?" He had them seldom any more, but they did come sometimes. The bloody memories of Culloden, of futile death and slaughter, prison dreams of hunger and confinement, and sometimes, very rarely, Jack Randall returned to him in sleep with loving cruelty. Such dreams would always drive him from his bed to walk to and fro for hours until exhaustion cleansed him of their visions. But he had not dreamed that way since Moore's Creek Bridge.
"No," he said, sounding half surprised. "Not at all. I dreamed of her, of our lassie, and the bairns."
My heart gave an odd little hop, the consequence of startlement, and what might almost have been envy. "You dreamed about Brianna and the children? What happened?" He smiled, face tranquil and abstracted in the moonlight, as though he still saw some part of the dream before him.
"It's all right," he said. "They're safe. I saw them in a town. It seemed like Inverness, but it was different somehow. They walked up the step of a house. Roger Mack was with them," he added offhand. "They knocked at the door, and a wee brown-haired woman opened to them. She laughed with joy to see them and brought them in, and they went down a hallway with strange things like bowls hanging from the ceiling. Then they were in a room with sofas and chairs, and the room had great windows all down one wall, from the floor to the ceiling, and the afternoon sun was streaming in, setting Brianna's hair to fire and making wee Mandy cry when it got in her eyes."
Did any of them call the brown-haired woman by name?" I asked, my heart beating in a queer, fast way. He frowned, moonlight making a cross of light over nose and brows.
"Aye, they did," he said. "I kinda just... Oh, aye. Roger Mack called her Fiona."
"Did he?" I said. My hands rested on his shoulder, and my mouth was 100 times drier than it had been when I woke up. The night was chilly, but not enough to account for the temperature of my hands. I had told Jamie any amount of things about my own time over the years of our marriage, about trains and planes and automobiles and wars and indoor plumbing. But I was nearly sure that I had never told him what the study looked like in the manse where Roger had grown up with his adoptive father. The room, with the window wall, made to accommodate the Reverend's painting hobby. The manse with its long hallway, furnished with old-fashioned light fixtures shaped like hanging balls. And I knew I had never told him about the Reverend's last housekeeper, a girl with dark curly hair, called Fiona. "Were they happy?" I asked at last, very quietly.
"Aye, Brianna and the lad. They had some shadows to their faces, but I could see they were glad nonetheless. They all sat down to eat, Brianna and her lad close together, leaning on each other. And wee Jem stuffed his face with cakes and cream."
He smiled at the picture, teeth a brief gleam in the darkness.
"Oh, at the last, just before I woke, wee Jem was messing about, picking things up and putting them down, as he does. There was a thing on the table. I couldn't see what it was. I've never seen the like."
He held his hands about 6 inches apart, frowning at them.
"It was maybe this wide and just a bit longer. Something like a box, maybe. Only sort of humped."
"Humped?" I said, puzzled as to what this could be.
"Aye. And it had a thing on top, like a wee club,
only we a knob to each end. And the club was tied to the box with a sort of black cord, curled up on itself like a piggy's tail. Jem saw it, and he reached out his hand and said, "I want to talk to Granda." And then I woke.
He leaned his head back further so as to look up into my face.
"Would you ken what a thing like that might be, Sassenach? It was like nothing I've ever seen."
The autumn wind came rustling down from the hill, dry leaves hurrying in its wake, quick and light as the footsteps of a ghost, and I felt the hair rise on nape and forearms.
"Yes, I know," I said. "I've told you about them, I know. I didn't think, though, that I'd ever described one to him in more than general terms."
I cleared my throat. "It's called a telephone." Chapter 122. The Guardian. It was November. There were no flowers, but the holly bushes gleamed dark green and the berries had begun to ripen. I cut a small bunch, careful of the prickles, added a tender branch of spruce for fragrance, and climbed the steep trail to the tiny graveyard. I went every week to leave some small token on Malva's grave and say a prayer. She and her child hadn't been buried with a cairn. Her father hadn't wanted such a pagan custom. But people came and left pebbles there by way of remembrance. It gave me some small comfort to see them. There were others who remembered her. I stopped abruptly at the head of the trail. Someone was kneeling by her grave, a young man. I caught the murmur of his voice, low and conversational, and would have turned to go, save that he raised his head and the wind caught his hair, short and tufted like an owl's feathers. Alan Christie. He saw me too and stiffened. There was nothing to do but go and speak to him, though, and so I went. "Mr. Christie," I said, the words feeling strange in my mouth. That was what I'd called his father. "I'm sorry for your loss." He stared up at me blankly, then some sort of awareness seemed to stir in his eyes. Grey eyes, rimmed with black lashes, so much like those of his father and sister. Bloodshot with weeping and lack of sleep, judging from the shocking smudges under them.
"Aye," he said. "My loss."
"Aye." I stepped around to lay down my evergreen bouquet, and with a small spurt of alarm saw that there was a pistol on the ground beside him, cocked and primed. "Where have you been?" I said, as casually as possible under the circumstances. "We've missed you." He shrugged, as though it really didn't matter where he'd been. Perhaps it didn't. He wasn't looking at me anymore, but at the stone we'd placed at the head of her grave.
"Places," he said vaguely. "But I had to come back."
He turned away a little, plainly indicating that he wanted me to leave. Instead, I pulled up my skirts and knelt gingerly beside him. I didn't think he'd blow his brains out in front of me. I had no idea what to do, other than to try to make him talk to me, and hope that someone else would come along. "We're glad to have you home," I said, trying for an easy conversational note. "Aye," he said vaguely, and again his eyes going to the headstone.
"I had to come back."
His hand wandered toward the pistol, and I seized it, startling him. "I know you loved your sister very much," I said. It was a terrible shock to you, I know."
What did one say?"
"There were things one might say to a person contemplating suicide, I knew. But what?"
"Your life has value."
I'd said that to Tom Christie, who had only replied,
"If it did not, this would not matter."
But how should I convince his son of that?
"Your father loved you both," I said, wondering as I said it whether he knew what his father had done.
His fingers were very cold, and I wrapped both my hands round his, trying to offer him a little warmth, hoping that the human contact would help.
"Not as I loved her," he said softly, not looking at me. "I loved her all her life, from the time she was born, and they gave her me to hold. There was nae other for either of us. Feyther was gone to prison, and then my mither. Ah, mither."
His lips pulled back as though to laugh, but there was no sound.
I know about your mother, I said. Your father told me.
Did he?
His head jerked up to look at me, eyes clear and hard.
Did he tell you? They took me and Mulver to her execution?
I... no. I don't think he knew, did he? My stomach clenched.
He did. I told him later when he sent for us, brought us here. He said that was good. We'd seen with our own eyes the ends of wickedness. He bade me remember the lesson. And so I did,
he added more quietly.
How old were you?
I asked, horrified.
10.
Malva was nae more than 2. She'd no idea what was happening. She cried out for her mam when they brought Mither out to the hangsman, and kicked and screamed, reaching out for her. He swallowed and turned his head away. I tried to take her, to push her head into my bosom so that she shouldn't see.
But they wouldn't let me have her.
They held her wee head and made her watch, and Auntie Darla saying in her ear that this was what happened to witches, and pinching her legs till she shrieked.
We lived with Auntie Darla for 6 years after that, he said, his face remote. She wasn't best pleased about it, but she said she kent her Christian duty. The old bosom barely fed us, and 'twas me took care of Mulva.
He was silent for a bit, and so was I, thinking the best, the only thing I could offer him now, was the chance to speak. He pulled his hand from mine, leaned over, and touched the gravestone. It was no more than a lump of granite, but someone had gone to the trouble to carve her name on it. Only the one word, Mulva, in crude block letters. It reminded me of the memorials that dotted Culloden, the clan stones, each with a single name.
She was perfect, he whispered.
His finger traced its way over the stone, delicate, as though he touched her flesh.
So perfect. Her wee privates looked like a flower's bud, and her skin sae fresh and soft.
A sense of coldness grew in the pit of my stomach. Did he mean...
Yes, of course he did.
A sense of inevitable despair began to grow within me.
She was mine, he said,
and looking up to see my eye upon him, repeated it more loudly.
She was mine.
He looked down then at the grave, and his mouth turned in upon itself in grief and anger.
The old man never knew, never guessed what we were to each other.
Didn't he? I thought. Tom Christie might have confessed to the crime to save one he loved. But he loved more than one. Having lost a daughter, or rather, a niece, would he not do all he could to save the son who was the last remnant of his blood?
You killed her, I said quietly. I was in no doubt, and he showed no surprise.
He would have sold her away, given her to some clod of a farmer.
Alan's fist clenched on his thigh. I thought of that as she grew older, and sometimes when I would lie with her, I couldn't bear the thought and would slap her face only from the rage of thinking of it. He drew a deep, ragged breath.
It wasn't her fault, none of it.
But I thought it was.
And then I caught her with that soldier and again with filthy wee Henderson. I beat her for it. But she cried out that she couldn't help it. She was with child.
Yours?
He nodded slowly.
I never thought of it. I should, of course, but I never did. She was always wee Mulva, see? A bitty wee lass. I saw her breasts swell high and the hair come out to mar her sweet flesh, but I just never thought.
He shook his head, unable to deal with the thought even now.
She said she must marry, and there must be reason for her husband to think the child his, whoever she wed. If she couldn't make the soldier wed her, then it must be another. So she took as many lovers as she might, quickly. I put a stop to that, though, he assured me, a faintly nauseating tone of self-righteousness in his voice. I told her I wouldn't have it. I would think of another way.
And so you put her up to saying the child was Jamie's?
My horror at the story and my anger at what he had done to us was subsumed by a flood of sorrow. Oh, Mulva, I thought in despair. Oh, my darling Mulva, why didn't you tell me?
But of course, she wouldn't have told me. Her only confidant was Alan.
He nodded and reached out to touch the stone again. A gust of wind quivered through the holly, stirring the stiff leaves.
That would explain the Bairnsie, but she wouldn't have to wed anyone. I thought himself would give her money to go away, and I would go with her. We could go to Canada, perhaps, or to the Indies.
His voice sounded dreamy, as though he envisioned some idyllic life where no one knew.
But why did you kill her? I burst out. What made you do that?
The sorrow and the senselessness were overwhelming. I clenched my hands in my apron not to batter him.
I had to, he said heavily.
She said she couldn't go through with it.
He blinked, looking down, and I saw that his eyes were heavy with tears.
She said she loved you, he said, low-voiced and thick. She couldn't hurt you so. She meant to tell the truth. No matter what I said to her, she just kept saying that. She loved you, and she'd tell.
He closed his eyes, shoulders slumping. Two tears ran down his cheeks.
Why, Hinny? He cried, crossing his arms over his belly in a spasm of grief. Why did you make me do it? You shouldn't have loved anyone but me.
He sobbed then like a child, and curled into himself, weeping. I was weeping, too, for the loss and the pointlessness, for the utter terrible waste of it all. But I reached out and took the gun from the ground. Hands shaking, I dumped out the priming pan and shook the ball from the barrel, then put the pistol in the pocket of my apron. Leave, I said, my voice half-choked. Go away again, Alan. There are too many people dead. He was too grief-stricken to hear me. I shook him by the shoulder and said it again, more strongly.
You can't kill yourself. I forbid it, do you hear? And who are you to say? He cried, turning on me. His face was contorted with anguish. I cannot live. I cannot.
But Tom Christie had given up his life for his son as well as for me. I couldn't let that sacrifice go for naught.
You must, I said, and stood up, feeling light-headed, unsure whether my knees would hold me.
Do you hear me? You must.
He looked up, eyes burning through the tears, but didn't speak. There was a keening whine like the hum of a mosquito, and a soft, sudden thump. He didn't change expression, but his eyes slowly died. He stayed on his knees for a moment, but bowed then forward, like a flower nodding on its stem. So I saw the arrow protruding from the centre of his back. He coughed once, sputtering blood, and fell sideways, curled on his sister's grave. His legs jerked spasmodically, grotesquely frog-like. Then he lay still.
I stood stupidly, staring at him for some immeasurable span of time, becoming only gradually aware that Ian had walked out of the wood and stood beside me, bow over his shoulder. Rollo nosed curiously at the body, whining.
"He's right, Auntie," Ian said quietly. "He can't."
Chapter 123. Return of the Native.
Old Granny Amonathy looked at least 102. She admitted, under pressure, to 91. She was nearly blind and nearly deaf, curled up like a pretzel from osteoporosis, and with skin gone so fragile that the merest scrape tore it like paper.
"I'm nae more than a bag o' bones," she said every time I saw her, shaking a head that trembled with palsy. "But at least I've still got Mr. Mateith." For a wonder, she had. I thought that was the only reason she'd made it this far. Unlike many people half her age, she wasn't reduced to living on porridge, but could still stomach meat and greens. Perhaps it was improved nutrition that kept her going. Perhaps it was mere stubbornness. Her married name was Abernathy, but she had, she confided, been born a Fraser.
smiling at the thought. I finished wrapping the bandage about her stick-like shin. Her legs and feet had almost no flesh upon them, and felt hard and cold as wood. She'd knocked her shin against the leg of the table, and taken off a strip of skin the width of a finger. Such a minor injury that a younger person would think nothing of it. But her family worried over her, and had sent for me. "It will be slow healing, but if you keep it clean, for God's sake, do not let her put hog fat on it. I think it will be all right." The younger Mrs. Abernathy, known as Young Granny, herself about 70, gave me a sharp eye at that. Like her mother-in-law, she put a good deal of faith in hog fat and turpentine as cure-alls, but nodded grudgingly. Her daughter, whose high-flown name of Arabella had been shortened to the cosier Granny Belly, grinned at me behind Young Granny's back. She'd been less fortunate in the way of teeth. Her smile showed significant gaps, but was cheerful and good-natured. "Willie B.," she instructed a teenaged grandson, "just be stepping doon to the root cellar and bring up a wee sack of turnips for herself." I made the usual protestations, but all parties concerned were comfortably aware of the proper protocol in such matters. And within a few minutes, I was on my way home the richer by 5 pounds of turnips. They were welcome. I had forced myself to go back to my garden in the spring after Mulver's death. I had to. Sentiment was all very well, but we had to eat. The subsequent disturbances of life and my prolonged absences, though, had resulted in dreadful neglect of the autumn crop. Despite Mrs. Bug's best efforts, the turnips had all succumbed to thrips and black rot. Our supplies in general were sadly depleted. With Jamie and Ian gone so frequently, not there to harvest or hunt, and without Bree and Roger, the grain crops had been half of their usual yield, and only a pitiful single haunch of venison hung in the smoking shed. We needed nearly all the grain for our own use. There was none to trade or sell, and only a few scant bags of barleycorn sat under canvas near the malting shed, where they were likely to rot, I thought grimly, as no one had had time to see to the malting of a fresh batch before the cold weather set in. Mrs. Bug was slowly rebuilding her flock of chickens after a disastrous attack by a fox that had got into the henhouse. But it was slow going, and we got only the occasional egg for breakfast, grudgingly spared. On the other hand, I reflected more cheerfully, we did have ham. Lots of ham. Likewise, immense quantities of bacon, head cheese, pork chops, tenderloin, to say nothing of suet and rendered fat. The thought led me back to hog fat and to the crowded, overflowingly familiar cosiness of the Abernathy's cluster of cabins, and by contrast, to thought of the dreadful emptiness at the big house. In a place with so many people, how could the loss of only four be so important? I had to stop and lean against a tree, let the sorrow wash through me, making no attempt to stop it. I'd learned. "You cannot hold a ghost at bay," Jamie had told me. "Let them in." I let them in. I could never keep them out. And took what small comfort I could in hoping... No, I didn't hope, I told myself fiercely. I knew that they weren't ghosts, in fact. Not dead, but only... elsewhere. After a few moments, the overwhelming grief began to recede, going slowly as the ebbing tide. Sometimes it uncovered treasure. Small, forgotten images of Jemmy's face smeared with honey, Brianna's laughter, Roger's hands deft with a knife, carving one of the little cars. The house was still littered with them, then leaning to spear a muffin from a passing plate. And if to look at these caused fresh pain, at least I had them and could keep them in my heart, knowing that in the fullness of time they would bring consolation. I breathed and felt the tightness in my chest and throat ease. Amanda was not the only one who might benefit from modern surgery, I thought.
I couldn't tell what might be done for Roger's vocal cords, but maybe. And yet his voice now was good, full and resonant, if rough. Perhaps he would choose to keep it as it was. He'd fought for it and earned it. The tree I leaned against was a pine. The needles swayed softly above me, then settled as though in agreement. I had to go. It was late in the day, and the air was growing colder. Wiping my eyes, I settled the hood of my cloak and went on. It was a long walk from the Abernathys. I should really have ridden Clarence, but he'd come up lame the day before, and I'd let him rest. I'd have to hurry, though, if I was to reach home before dark. I cast a wary eye upward, judging the clouds, which had that soft, uniform grey of coming snow. The air was cold and thick with moisture. When the temperature dropped at nightfall, snow would fall. The sky was still light, but only just as I came down past the spring house and into the backyard. Light enough to tell me that something was wrong, though. The back door stood open. That set off alarm bells, and I turned to run back into the woods. I turned and ran smack into a man who had come out of the trees behind me. "Who the hell are you?" I demanded, stepping hastily back. "Don't worry about that, missus," he said, and, grabbing me by the arm, yelled toward the house, "Hey, Donna! I got her!" Whatever Wendigo Donna had been doing for the last year, it hadn't been profitable by the looks of him. Never a natty dresser at the best of times, he was now so ragged that his coat was literally falling apart, and a slice of stringy buttock showed through a rent in his breeches. His mane of hair was greasy and matted, and he stank.
"Where are they?" he demanded hoarsely.
"Where are what?" I swung round to face his companion, who seemed in slightly better condition. "And where are my housemaid and her sons?" We were standing in the kitchen, and the hearth-fire was out. Mrs. Bug hadn't come that morning, and wherever Amy and the boys were, they'd been gone for some time.
"Dunno," the man shrugged, indifferent. "Wasn't nobody to home when we came."
"Where are the jewels?"
Donna grabbed at my arm, jerking me round to face him. His eyes were sunk in his head, and his grip was hot. He was burning with fever.
"I haven't got any," I said shortly. "You're ill. You should..."
"You do. I know you do. Everybody knows."
That gave me momentary pause. Gossip being what it was, everybody likely thought they knew that Jamie had a small cache of jewels. Small wonder if word of this hypothetical treasure had reached Donna, and little likelihood that I could convince him otherwise. I had no choice but to try, though. "They're gone," I said simply. Something flickered in his eyes at that.
"How?"
he said. I raised an eyebrow in the direction of his accomplice. Did he want the man to know?
"Go find Richie and Jed,"
Donna said briefly to the thug, who shrugged and went out. Richie and Jed? How on earth many people had he brought? Past the first shock of seeing him, I now became aware that there were thumping feet upstairs, and the sound of cupboard doors being banged impatiently down the hall.
"My surgery! Get them out of there!"
I dove for the door to the hallway, intending to perform this office myself, but Donna grabbed at my cloak to stop me. I was bloody tired of being manhandled, and I wasn't afraid of this miserable excuse for a human being.
"Let go," I snapped, and kicked him briskly in the kneecap to emphasize the point. He yelped, but let go.
I could hear him cursing behind me as I rushed through the door and down the hall. Papers and books had been flung out into the hallway from Jamie's office, and a puddle of ink had been poured over them. The explanation of the ink was apparent when I saw the thug rifling my surgery. He had a big blot of ink on the front of his shirt, where he had apparently sequestered the stolen pewter inkwell.
"What are you doing, you nitwit?" I said.
The thug, a boy of 16 or so, blinked at me, mouth open. He had one of Mr. Blogweather's perfect glass globes in his hand. At this, he grinned maliciously and let it drop to the floor, where it shattered into a spray of fragments. One of the flying shards lanced through his cheek, slicing it open. He didn't feel it until the blood began to well. Then he put a hand to the wound, frowning in puzzlement, and bellowed in fright at the blood on his hand. "Crap," said Donna behind me. He put his arms around me and dragged me after him back to the kitchen.
"Look," he said urgently, releasing me. "All I want is two. You can keep the rest. I've got to have one to pay these guys, and one to travel with."
"But it's true," I insisted, knowing that he wouldn't believe me. "We haven't got any. My daughter and her family, they've gone. Gone back. They used all we had. There aren't any more." He stared at me, disbelief plain in his burning eyes.
"Yes, there are," he said positively. "There have to be. I've got to get out of here."
"Why?"
"Never you mind. I've got to go, and quick."
He swallowed, eyes darting around the kitchen as though the gems might be sitting casually on the sideboard.
"Where are they?"
A hideous crash from the surgery, followed by an outbreak of shouted curses, prevented any reply I might have made. I moved by reflex toward the door, but Donna moved in front of me. I was infuriated at this invasion and beginning to be alarmed. While I'd never seen any indication of violence from Donna, I wasn't so sure about the men he'd brought with him. They might eventually give up and leave when it became apparent that there were, in fact, no gems on the premises, or they might try to beat the location of said gems out of me. I pulled my cloak more tightly around myself and sat down on a bench, trying to think calmly. "Look," I said to Donna, "you've taken the house apart." A crash from upstairs shook the house and I jumped. My God, it sounded as though they'd tipped over the wardrobe. "You've taken the house apart," I repeated through gritted teeth, "and you haven't found anything. Wouldn't I give them to you if I had any, to save you wrecking the place?"
"No, I don't reckon you would. I wouldn't, if I was you."
He rubbed a hand across his mouth.
"You know what's going on, the war and all."
He shook his head in confusion.
"I didn't know it would be this way, swear to God. Half the people I meet don't know which way is up any more. I thought it'd be like, you know, redcoats and all, and you'd just keep away from anybody in a uniform. Keep away from the battles and it'd be fine. But I haven't seen a redcoat anywhere. And people, you know, just plain old people. They're shooting each other and running around, burning up each other's houses."
He closed his eyes for a minute. His cheeks went from red one moment to white the next. I could see he was very ill. I could hear him, too, the breath rattling wetly in his chest, and he wheezed faintly. If he fainted, how would I get rid of his companions?
"Anyway," he said, opening his eyes, "I'm going. Going back. I don't care what things are like then. It's a hell of a lot better than here."
"What about the Indians?" I inquired, with no more than a touch of sarcasm. "Leaving them to their own devices, are you?"
"Yeah," he said, missing the sarcasm. "Tell you the truth, I'm not so keen on Indians any more either."
He rubbed absently at his upper chest, and I saw a large, puckered scar through a rent in his shirt.
"Man," he said, longing clear in his voice, "what I wouldn't give for a cold bud and a baseball game on TV.
Then his wandering attention snapped back to me.
"So," he said, in a halfway reasonable tone, "I need those diamonds, or whatever. Hand 'em over, and we'll leave."
I'd been turning over various schemes for getting rid of them, to no particular avail, and was getting more uneasy by the moment. We had very little worth stealing, and from the looks of the rifled sideboard, they'd already got what there was, including, I realised with a fresh stab of alarm, the pistols and powder. Before too much longer, they'd grow impatient. Someone might come. Amy and the boys were likely at Brianna's cabin, which they were in process of moving into. They could come back at any moment. Someone could come looking for Jamie or myself, though the chances of that receded by the moment with the dying light. Even if someone did, though, the effect was likely to be disastrous.
Then I heard voices on the front porch, and the stamping of feet, and leapt to my own feet, my heart in my mouth.
"Would you quit doing that?" Donna said irritably. "You're the jumpiest twat I ever saw."
I ignored him, having recognized one of the voices. Sure enough, in the next moment, two of the thugs, brandishing pistols, shoved Jamie into the kitchen. He was wary and disheveled, but his eyes went immediately to me, running up and down my body to assure himself that I was all right.
"I'm fine," I said briefly. "These idiots think we have gemstones, and they want them."
"So they said."
He straightened himself, shrugging to settle the coat on his shoulders, and glanced at the cupboards hanging open, and the despoiled sideboard. Even the pie hutch had been overturned, and the remains of a raisin pie lay squashed on the floor, marked with a large heel print.
"I gather they've looked."
"Look, mate," said one of the thugs reasonably, "all we want's the swag. Just tell us where it is and we go. No harm done, eh?"
Jamie rubbed the bridge of his nose, eyeing the man who had spoken.
"I imagine my wife has told you that we have no gems."
"Well, she would, wouldn't she?" the thug said tolerantly. "Women, you know."
He seemed to feel that now Jamie had showed up, they could get on with things in a more businesslike fashion, man to man. Jamie sighed and sat down.
"Why do you think I've got any?"
he inquired, rather mildly.
"I have had, I admit,
but no longer.
They've been sold."
"Where's the money, then?"
The second thug was obviously quite willing to settle for that, no matter what Donna thought.
"Spent," said Jamie briefly. "I'm a colonel of militia. Surely you ken that much. It's an expensive business, provisioning a militia company. Food, guns, powder, shoes. It adds up, aye? Why, the cost in shoe leather alone. And then to say nothing of the shoeing for the horses. Wagons, too, you wouldn't have believed the scandalous cost of wagons."
One of the thugs was frowning, but half-nodding, following this reasonable exegesis. Donna and his other companion were noticeably agitated, though.
"Shut up about the damn wagons," Donna said rudely,
and bending, he snatched up one of Mrs. Bug's butcher knives from the floor.
"Now, look," he said, scowling and trying to look menacing. "I've had it with the stalling around. You tell me where they are, or I'll cut her. Yeah, I'll cut her throat. Swear I will."
With this, he clutched me by the shoulder and put the knife to my throat. It had become clear to me some little time ago that Jamie was stalling for time, which meant that he expected something to happen, which in turn meant he was expecting someone to come. That was reassuring, but I did think the apparent nonchalance of his demeanour in the face of my theoretically impending demise was perhaps carrying things a trifle too far.
"Oh," he said, scratching at the side of his neck. "Well, I wouldn't have do that if I were you. She's the one who kens where the gems are, aye?"
"I what?" I cried indignantly. "She is."
One of the other thugs brightened at that.
"Oh, aye," Jamie assured him. "Last time I went out with the militia, she hid them. Wouldn't tell me where she'd put them." "Wait, I thought you said you'd sold them and spent the money," Donna said, plainly confused.
"I was lying," Jamie explained, patient.
"Oh, but if you're going to kill my wife, well then, of course, that alters the case."
"Oh," said Donna, looking somewhat happier.
"Yeah, exactly."
"I believe we have not been introduced, sir,"
Jamie said politely, extending a hand.
"I am James Fraser, and you are..."
Donna hesitated for a moment, unsure what to do with the knife in his right hand, but then shifted it awkwardly to his left and leaned forward to shake Jamie's hand briefly.
"Wendigo, Donna," he said. "Okay, now we're getting somewhere."
I made a rude noise, but it was drowned by a series of crashes and the sound of breaking glass from the surgery. The lout in there must be clearing the shelves wholesale, flinging bottles and jars on the floor. I grasped Donna's hand and pulled the knife away from my throat, then sprang to my feet in much the same state of insane fury in which I had once torched a field full of grasshoppers. This time it was Jamie who seized me around the middle as I darted toward the door, swinging me half off my feet. "Let go! I'll frigging kill him!" I said, kicking madly.
"Well, wait just a bit about that, Sassenach," he said, low-voiced,
and lugged me back to the table where he sat down with his arms wrapped around me, holding me firmly pinned on his lap. Further sounds of depredation came down the hall, the splintering of wood and crunch of glass under a boot-heel. Evidently the young lout had given up searching for anything and was simply destroying for the fun of it. I took a deep breath, preparatory to emitting a scream of frustration, but stopped.
"Jeez," Donna said, wrinkling his nose. "What's that smell? Somebody caught one?"
He looked accusingly at me, but I paid no attention. It was ether, heavy and sickly sweet. Jamie stiffened slightly. He knew what it was, too, and essentially what it did. Then he took a deep breath and carefully moved me off his lap, setting me on the bench beside him. I saw his eyes go to the knife sagging in Donna's hand, and heard what his keener ears had already picked up. Someone was coming. He moved a little forward, getting his feet under him to spring, and flicked his eyes toward the cold hearth, where a heavy Dutch oven was sitting in the ashes. I nodded very briefly, and as the back door opened, made a lunge across the kitchen. Donna, with unexpected swiftness, stuck out a leg and tripped me. I fell headlong and slid, fetching up against the settle with a head-ringing thump. I groaned and lay still for a few moments, eyes closed, feeling all at once that I was much too old for this sort of carry-on. I opened my eyes reluctantly, and very stiffly got to my feet, to find the kitchen now full of people. Donna's original sidekick had returned with two others, presumably Richie and Jed, and with them the bugs, Merdina looking alarmed and Arch coldly furious. "Aliannan," Mrs. Bug cried, rushing toward me. "Are you hurt, then?" "No, no," I said, still rather dazed. "Just let me sit down for a moment." I looked at Donna, but he no longer held his knife. He'd been frowning at the floor. Evidently he had dropped it when he tripped me, but his head jerked up at sight of the newcomers.
"What? Did you find anything?"
he asked eagerly, for both Richie and Jed were beaming with self-importance.
"Sure did," one of them assured him. "Look at here."
He was holding Mrs. Bug's work bag, and at this he upended it and shook the contents out onto the table, where a mass of woolly knitting landed with a massive thunk. Eager hands pawed the wool away, revealing an 8-inch-long ingot of gold. The metal shaved away at one end, and stamped in the centre with the Royal French fleur-de-lis. Stunned silence followed the appearance of this apparition. Even Jamie looked completely nonplussed. Mrs. Bug had been pale when they came in. Now she had gone the colour of chalk, and her lips had disappeared. Archer's eyes went straight to Jamie's, dark and defiant. The only person unimpressed by sight of the glowing metal was Donna.
"Well, Neato Mosquito," he said. "What about the jewels? Keep your eye on the goal here, people."
His accomplices, however, had lost interest in theoretical jewels, with solid gold actually in hand, and were simultaneously discussing the possibility of more, and squabbling over who should have custody of the present ingot. My own head was spinning, from the blow, from the sudden appearance of the ingot, and its revelations regarding the bugs, and particularly from the fumes of ether, which were getting notably stronger. No one in the kitchen had noticed, but all sound from the surgery had ceased. The young lout in there had undoubtedly passed out. The bottle of ether had been nearly full, enough to anaesthetize a dozen elephants, I thought dizzily, or a houseful of people. Already I could see Donna struggling to keep his head upright. A few minutes more, and all the thugs would likely have subsided into a state of innocuous desuetude. But so would we. Ether is heavier than air, The stuff would sink to the floor, where it would gradually rise in a pool around our knees. I stood up, taking a quick breath from the presumably purer air higher up. I had to get the window open. Jamie and Arch were speaking Gaelic to each other, much too fast for me to follow, even had my head been in normal working order. Donna was frowning at them, mouth open, as though he meant to tell them to stop, but couldn't quite find the words. I fumbled with the catch of the inside shutters, having to concentrate very hard in order to make my fingers work. Finally, the latch flipped free, and I swung the shutter open, revealing the leering face of an unfamiliar Indian in the twilight outside the window. I shrieked and staggered back. Next thing, the back door sprang open, and a squat, bearded figure rushed in, bellowing in some incomprehensible tongue, followed by Ian, who was followed by yet another strange Indian screaming and laying about himself with something, tomahawk, club. I couldn't get my eyes to focus well enough to tell. All was pandemonium, seen through glazed eyes. I clutched the windowsill to keep from sinking to the floor, but couldn't summon the presence of mind to open the damn window. Everyone was struggling and fighting, but the inhabitants of the kitchen were doing it in slow motion, yelling and staggering like drunks. As I watched, my mouth hanging unbecomingly open, Jamie painstakingly drew Donna's knife out from under his buttocks, brought it up in a slow, graceful arc, and buried it under Donna's breastbone. Something flew past my ear and crashed through the window, destroying what was probably the only intact pane of glass left in the house. I breathed in deep gulps of fresh air, trying to clear my head, and made frantic waving motions with my hands, shouting, or trying to shout, "Get out! Get out!" Mrs. Bug was trying to do just that, crawling on hands and knees toward the half-open door. Arch hit the wall and slid slowly down beside her, face gone blank. Donna had fallen face forward over the table, his blood dripping nastily onto the floorboards, and another thug was lying in the extinct hearth, his skull crushed. Jamie was still upright, swaying, and the squat bearded figure was standing beside him, shaking his head, and looking confused as the fumes began to affect him. "What's going on?" I heard him ask. The kitchen was nearly dark now, the figures swaying like fronds of kelp in some underwater forest. I closed my eyes for a second. When I opened them again, Ian was saying, "Wait, I'll light a candle." He had one of Brianna's matches in his hand, the tin in the other. "Ian!" I shrieked. And then he struck the match. There was a soft woof noise, and then a louder whoomp as the ether in the surgery ignited, and suddenly we were standing in a pool of fire. For a fraction of a second, I felt nothing, and then a burst of searing heat. Jamie seized my arm and hurled me toward the door. I staggered out, fell into the blackberry bushes, and rolled through them, thrashing and flailing at my smoking skirts. Panicked, and still uncoordinated from the ether, I struggled with the strings of my apron, finally managing to loose the strings and wriggle out of my apron. My linen petticoats were singed but not charred. I crouched, panting in the dead weeds of the dooryard, unable to do anything for the moment but breathe. The smell of smoke was strong and pungent. Mrs. Bug was on the back porch on her knees, jerking off her cap, which was on fire. Men erupted through the back door, beating at their clothes and hair. Rollo was in the yard, barking hysterically, and on the other side of the house, I could hear the screams of frightened horses. Someone had got Arch Bug out. He was stretched at full length in the dead grass, most of his hair and eyebrows gone, but evidently still alive. My legs were red and blistered, but I wasn't badly burned. Thank God for layers of linen and cotton, which burn slowly, I thought groggily. Had I been wearing something modern like rayon, I should have gone up like a torch. The thought made me look back toward the house. It was full dark by now, and all the windows on the lower floor were alight. Flame danced in the open door. The place looked like an immense jack-o'-lantern.
Your mistress Fraser, I suppose?
The squat, bearded person bent over me, speaking in a soft Scottish burr. Yes, I said, coming gradually to myself. Who are you? And where's Jamie?
Here, Sassenach.
Jamie stumbled out of the dark and sat down heavily beside me. He waved a hand at the Scotsman.
May I present Mr. Alexander Cameron, known more generally as Scotchy? Your servant, ma'am, he said politely.
I was feeling gingerly at my hair. Clumps of it had been singed to crispy thread, but at least I still had some. I felt, rather than saw, Jamie look up at the house. I followed the direction of his gaze and saw a dark figure at the window upstairs, framed in the dim glow from the burning downstairs. He shouted something in the incomprehensible tongue and began throwing things out of the window.
"Who's that?"
I asked, feeling more than slightly surreal.